Good morning. You're listening to author, activist, and journalist Cory Doctorow and Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Good morning! Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for August 31st, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenplum.
And I'm Pam Bedour.
Professor Pam is back! Oh my goodness! Pamela Bedour, so wonderful to see you. Thank you so much for coming back after a month of being not on the show. It's so wonderful to see you.
It's great to see you guys too. And it certainly doesn't feel like a month. It went by very quickly.
Well, you're on sabbatical, so time runs differently for you, madam.
Yes, we'll be talking about time dilation.
Just going to ensure that we're still literate, Steve.
Yes, that you can tell. You know it's going to be a good episode of Too Much Scrolling when Professor Pamela Bedour joins us, and you know it's going to be a literature episode.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. Hey, Chip, did you go to the movie theater and watch anything this week?
I didn't go to the movie theater, Steve.
this is going great. I have continued my study of animation over the course of Too Much Scrolling and watched the next episode of What If, the Disney Plus series that takes the Marvel Cinematic Universe and turns it on its head by changing one little detail. And boy, oh boy, episode 3, Chip, the one little detail that they changed, I cannot tell you because it is a mystery that needs to be solved. And the end of the episode is where they tell you what the one tiny little change is. But as a result of that one tiny little change, all of the Avengers die in this episode.
So is the purpose of this series to set up the multiple universe series?
The more I watch it, the more I think that that is exactly what they're doing. That they have set up the multiverse in Spider-Man and in Loki. The Loki series, I'm revisiting and trying to piece together what I think Marvel will do with the future. And yes, that's what I think is happening here.
So the new Spider-Man trailer came out this week, and it introduces I'll give you a spoiler, a character coming back from a previous series, Spider-Man series. So with one of the other actors. So, you know, the idea of the multiverse is truly going to be there.
And we know that the Doctor Strange movie focuses on the multiverse as well. So yes, I think I'm going to be even more of a Marvel fan in the next few years with the multiverse being the centerpiece of their storytelling.
So I see that snakes were not on the plane.
Yep, Samuel L. Jackson was in this episode, featured heavily as Nick Fury. Michael Douglas was in this one. Clark Gregg is there as Agent Coulson. Jeremy Renner is in this one, along with Mark Ruffalo as the Hulk. So we've got a lot of star power in this episode.
Well, you know, this is a cartoon, right? And so wonderful voice acting, it seems to be the latest trend for everybody.
It's the easiest job to do for all these actors. They can still play their characters from 30 years ago as long as they can make their voice sound like it's 30 years younger than it is today.
So do you recommend this series?
I recommend this to all of the Marvel Cinematic Universe fans, all the people that like the storytelling of the multiverse, all the people that have taken that course, that creative writing course, where you always are looking for some topic. The multiverse is a great way to start a short story.
All right, Steve, Paramount Plus seems to be continuing the 50th anniversary celebration of Star Trek. Tell me about Star Trek Lower Decks.
Yep, I'm still on Star Trek Lower Decks as well. Episode 3 is all about Star Trek Voyager, or as we now call it, and probably forever will, you know, Voy.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a whole joke. It was a whole joke in the whole episode. The one character is obsessed with Voyager, and he refers to it as Voy, and all the other characters like, why don't you just say Voyager? What are you even talking about? And by the end, everybody's calling it Voy. It was really well done. How about you, Chip? You've been watching some cartoons, too.
I did watch cartoons on Hulu. I ended up watching Solar Opposites Season 2. You may know Solar Opposites as the series that it has no relation to Rick and Morty, but it does have one of the voice actors and one of the creators, Justin Roiland. So Justin Roiland is the voice of Rick and Rick and Morty, and Justin Roiland is also the voice of Corvo in this. And what I can say is I love this man's delivery. He's got such a I don't know. It's like a broken delivery.
Okay.
And there's humor in this. The premise is that
I just point out that Chip loves somebody with a broken delivery, and then he stuttered through that sentence. I wonder why you like this, Chip.
I know. It's the best part. The premise is there is a dying planet. There's only a few survivors, and we've got a family that ultimately crashes on Earth. And their job is to recreate their destroyed planet here on Earth at some point. But we don't know exactly when that thing will start. There's a lot of humor in it. For a person who likes Rick and Morty, I'm sure that they will enjoy this series. I do think that series is very good. And the second season ends with a cliffhanger. That is probably not really much of a cliffhanger. It probably will just turn back into normal people and they'll be fine.
So he didn't really fall off the side of the mountain at the end?
No.
No, that's Sherlock Holmes. Sorry, that's Sherlock Holmes.
Maybe they'll make like a tree and leave.
Pam, have you watched anything in the last month since the last time we spoke to you?
Well, I did enjoy Suicide Squad, which I know you guys talked about. I also rewatched It Chapter One this week with my 12-year-old. And that was really fun because they were specifically watching it because they want to write fanfic about it. And so it's so interesting, this younger generation, they just interact with text in such a different way than our generation does. Not saying there aren't some fantastic fanfic writers in middle age, but my child was like, oh, I really have heard and read so much about this and I'd like to see it because I think I want to like put Georgie in a totally different universe. And so it was really fun. And I have to say, you guys watched it.
I watched it. Oh, yeah, I saw it. It was scary. I rented it from the video store, and then I rewound it because it was on VHS, and then I returned it. And the guy said, did you watch it? I said, yes, I watched it, and it was scary.
Thank you for that, Steve.
And Steve, I just wanted to remind you that there is a Skarsgård.
There is a Skarsgård in there.
Skarsgård.
Did you watch Castle Rock?
I have not yet.
Oh.
That's something I check out soon. I actually, you guys, I found out I'm teaching my Stephen King course in the spring semester. So this semester, I'm going to have so much fun figuring out which 7 or 8 novels to do.
Oh, boy. I would really highly recommend Castle Rock.
Okay. Thank you for reminding me. I've been meaning to watch that, so I will.
It is certainly an homage to Stephen King. It is certainly a mashup of Stephen King's style, but it is so well done, and the acting is wonderful.
Okay.
And there's a Skarsgård.
Did you say Skarsgård?
I will let you know when I've watched that. That will be great.
Maybe we'll have a discussion about that because that was so well put together. Speaking of well put together, there are some movies opening in theaters this week, Chip. Maybe you'll make it to one of these.
There is a Marvel movie, Steve.
There is. So maybe I'll make it to the movie theater this week. Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings is opening this week.
Based on a comic book that came out in the 1970s and 80s about martial arts, because martial arts was a really hot topic at the time. This is going to be integrated into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And, you know, this reminds me a little bit of the Iron Man film that had the Mandalorian that we were kind of tricked about. I'm wondering if it has maybe some connection.
Wow. The Marvel Cinematic Universe just keeps getting bigger and bigger, doesn't it?
It does. And they certainly, this is would be a, if Black Panther is a D-level type character, you're still going pretty deep into, this is an E or an F-level character that they're basically pulling out and making a star. I mean, this is a big deal.
They've done that so well with all of the other characters. The Guardians of the Galaxy was certainly a very low-rung hero, and they escalated that so well with that movie. I have high hopes for this one.
Steve, you know, back about 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, people really didn't think about how they had to name their children. Today, is there a name people would avoid?
Yeah, I would avoid naming your babies Karen, if possible, in 2021. I think that maybe the name Karen has come to mean something much bigger than itself in the last 16 months since the pandemic. And so BET, the Black Entertainment Channel, they are coming out with a feature simply titled Karen, and this is a horror movie featuring a racist woman who takes it as a personal mission to displace a new black family that just moved into her neighborhood.
And wow. If this works real well, Steve, will they name this the sequel Chad?
Book it. Brings us to our book it, our book of the week, and the reason that Professor Pamela Bedore has joined us is I really had one more book that I wanted to discuss in our book club sandwiches at irregular hours. Those of you who haven't gone back into the archives and listened to all of our discussions of 12 wonderful books and some not so wonderful books in our book club sandwiches at irregular hours, you should do that. But now it's time to move on to our 13th book in our list, and that is Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. This was published in 2021, and it is the follow-up to Andy Weir's other work. You might be familiar with The Martian was his first breakout hit.
And also Artemis, right, Steve?
And also Artemis. That is a great way to put it, Chip, because I think The Martian was a great book. I think Project Hail Mary is just as good as The Martian. And then there's Artemis.
I'll admit I haven't read Artemis, so I'll stay out of that. But boy, I love The Martian, and I loved this book.
Didn't we read Artemis? I think we read Artemis as a group read, Steve.
We did, and I did not like that book very much. I did not like the main character from page one of that book. This main character in Project Hail Mary, I loved him from the beginning. I don't know why, Pam.
It's very hard to imagine, Steve. I think that as I actually listened to the book, and I would definitely recommend the voice recording, but I heard Ryland Grace in Steve Fodor's voice the entire time because you're a middle school teacher, and Ryland Grace makes the middle school teacher position a heroic one. And so it's hard to imagine why you would like that, my dear friend.
He could stay back and save a few people, or he can go and save humanity.
He's not just a middle school teacher. He is a middle-aged geek, pop culture nerd, Gen Xer, middle school science teacher. There's no reason for me to like this character other than he is me in novel form.
I think they called him a photer. I don't know why they kept calling him a photer.
But it works, doesn't it?
He's such a fascinating character because he has here's where he's the opposite of you, Steve. He has no social life, mm-hmm. right? So he has no partner, he has no family, he has no close friends. And so in that way, he is this, he tells us he's a total hermit, but he doesn't act like a hermit. He feels like you. So that was one place where the characterization was kind of interesting, where when he leaves Earth, like no one, the only people he thinks he's going to miss are his students.
Mm-hmm.
Have anyone else in his life, but he doesn't feel like someone who has no one else in his life.
And as a teacher, absolutely, when Andy Weir wrote those words, I miss my students. I love my students, and I'm doing this for them. That is such a strong sentiment, and it's the way that teachers talk about students all the time. We truly work for them. We are thinking of them all the time and how we can help them and in turn help the world to become better. So we need to do a little bit of a summary of the plot here, right? We need to give people who haven't read this book an idea of what's going on. This book opens in the middle of the action, where Andy Weir throws us into the adventure of this man waking up on a spaceship, and he doesn't know that he's on a spaceship until he realizes that very quickly. He doesn't know why he's on a spaceship. He doesn't know his name. He doesn't know anything.
In fact, I think he had a sixth sense, because didn't he say, I see dead people?
Oh, yeah. He's alone on the ship because all of the other crew are no longer living. He is the only living being on the ship, and he has to solve the mystery of why he's there, how he got there, who he is in the very first chapter of this book.
And there's no Bruce Willis to guide him.
He's kind of a Bruce Willis, though, isn't he? If Bruce Willis could have gotten to a point where he could be a middle school teacher, this is kind of comedic Bruce Willis-y. No?
I think so.
He's a comedian. Yeah, I buy that. Yeah.
Maybe? Yeah. I don't know. I think I see more of a Ben Affleck playing this character because he looks so much like me.
You look a lot like Ryan Gosling, who I believe will be starring as Ryland Grace in the major motion picture.
Yeah, this has already been picked up for a movie, and Ryan Gosling, I could see Ryan Gosling pulling off this character. Again, he would have to find the empathy, find the feeling of, I am doing this for everyone else, and show us that emotion in the movie, and I hope that they're able to capture that same feeling from the book.
Well, because, yeah, I think that Ryland Grace's main characteristics are he's super filled with wonder, right? So he's constantly, he has that excitement that really draws you along as a reader, where he's like, oh my goodness, I'm on a suicide mission to save the earth, but isn't this cool? Like, I get to see something no one else has ever seen before. Oh my goodness, an alien. That's so exciting. So he has like, there's no angst to this character.
Yeah.
Right? He's on a suicide mission. He loves life. He desperately does not want to die, but he's able to sort of compartmentalize that and really just enjoy the adventure, even when it's super hard and horrible. And I think the voice right from the beginning, when he realizes like he's tied up to all these medical machines and like he says, whoa, you know, this is so disgusting, but oh, well, I wonder what happened. You know, he has his joie de vivre, which is perfect for a middle school teacher.
It is very emblematic of a middle school science teacher, that wonder, that sense of wonder, that let's see what will happen. Let's do an experiment. And Andy Weir's way of writing that works really well.
And there's a desire to survive, as opposed to dwelling on the negative.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And that could easily, the book could have easily gone that way. The character could have easily gone, like, you know, thrown his hands up and said it's impossible.
Mm-hmm. And there are some points in which he sort of does that, where he retreats mentally so that he can work out the thing that he's supposed to do. And we're not going to do too many spoilers here, but the angst comes in the storyline, where we find out how he got to the spaceship through a series of memories that come back to him slowly, and so well written in this story.
They did it dirty, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
They,
the not us, the not like us.
I agree. Some of the spoilers are so awesome. We won't go into them. But And you know I love to talk about endings, but we can't talk about the ending of this.
Nope.
It's too much of a pleasure for the reader to wait.
If we spent a whole month on it like we did in the book club, then we could have talked about the ending, but we're not going to do that today.
Now, the other thing I want to say is I think that Grace's other main characteristic, other than his optimism and sense of wonder, is his modesty, right? And so I feel like Weir did an incredible job of creating a believable character who has this level of science know-how, right? Mm-hmm. He does have a PhD, which not all middle school teachers have. Mm-hmm. He published extensively as an expert in his field. When he got bad reviews, he was like, forget it. I'm leaving the academy and I just want to teach. So he creates like a believable backstory where this guy who is literally like the number two guy in the world on the crisis that humanity faces somehow manages to be like, oh, but I'm just a middle school teacher like a million other people. So I think that Weir does a fantastic job. And I don't know how he did it. It's really crazy to create that character who's both an absolute top earth intellect
mm-hmm.
and an everyman. But he did it.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. It reminds me of so many of those action movies where the top Navy SEAL just happens to be the cook on the ship where he needs to be. It's totally that, but it is not in any way unbelievable. He had this moment where he was so brilliant, he published, and it was not rejected, but it was poo-pooed as not correct science. And he said, fine, I'm not going to do this anymore. It's not worth it for me. I'm going to pursue education from a different standpoint. And when this crisis hits Earth, they find him and he's the right man for the job and he's on the ship. And the rest of the adventure goes from there.
I'm reminded of a local person. He's passed away since then, but he created the game Diplomacy. And if you look up Diplomacy, it's one of the great games of all time.
I love that game. Yeah. I didn't realize that. Do you know the creator of the game?
I know the daughter.
Okay, wow.
But I want you to know that he was a brilliant guy. Certainly created a game that many people truly try to master. He worked for the post office. And the deal is that what someone chooses to do for a living, for any number of reasons, you know, is what they choose, but they still can do extraordinary things. So I don't think it's impossible for a person to master a subject, become an expert on a subject, but at some point may not find fulfillment in it or may not enjoy the game and basically withdraw to something that they enjoy. And it's just it could be just for quality of life.
Mm-hmm. And it's so well put together in this book. Andy Weir found a way to give us this character that I fell in love with almost immediately, and I was pulling for him and hoping that he was going to be successful in his mission. We find out pretty quickly what the crisis is on Earth. There is this thing that is eating the sun, and the Earth is in definite, absolute peril. And we get through a series of memories that slowly come back to our narrator that they decided that they needed to send a ship to try to solve this crisis.
Eventually, the sun turns red and then you don't have Superman powers anymore.
Different story. That's a different story.
Well, I love that you bring that up, Chip, because I was just going to say, this book reminded me of a few other books. So I feel like, not to be, you know, Amazon, but if you liked this book, I think you would also like The Martian, because the character, the way that Andy Weir creates this character, who's mostly by himself, like we spend most of the novel with just one or two characters, he does really draws you in and has, I think that the main character from The Martian has a lot of the same qualities. The scenario is very, very similar to that which Isaac Asimov uses in his wonderful 1972 novel, The Gods Themselves. Now, Asimov goes in a bit different direction, But there's, I think, a lot of influence from that novel. So as soon as I finished Project Hail Mary, I thought, ooh, I want to go back and read that Asimov novel. I bet it was a very influential read. The opening of this book, the person waking up in the spaceship who has no idea what's up, that is exactly like the opening of Octavia Butler's Dawn, another book that I super recommend from 1987. So I just want to get those plugs in there. Things you might want to read if you really enjoyed this.
And you should, you, Pam Bedore, you should be reading the Bobiverse, which is a very, very pop culture rich, referential, comedic sci-fi story about a man who has his mind frozen when he dies, and then he wakes up in a computer. His consciousness has been taken and put into a computer. And then that consciousness is tasked with piloting a spaceship. It is the computer that runs the spaceship. And the narrator on the Audible is the same narrator from this book. So the whole time, I'm thinking, wow, this is a reverential pop culture man on a spaceship with that same guy telling me the story. I love the Bobiverse series, and that narrator is fantastic, and I wish I could find his name fast enough.
Okay, well, thank you for that recommendation. I will definitely look that up.
So we get to, in this story, our lone astronaut in space actually runs into actual aliens. And the alien, singular, is alone on his spaceship. And the two of them have to work together. I hope that's not too spoilery, that's one of the main pieces of this narrative.
It was a pandemic, Steve. A lot of people were alone. Ooh. And they were very happy to find someone else.
Oh, that is very good insight, Chip. The idea of being alone and having this global crisis and having to find a way around this crisis and to have the personal connection with another being. Wow, that's deep.
And of course, aliens are, you know, you love time travel, Steve. I love aliens the way you love time travel. I think that, you know, the Iridians are awesome aliens.
May I suggest a time-traveling alien? His name is Doctor Who.
Indeed. I believe I've heard of him. Or her.
Who?
Yes.
So I feel like Andy Weir took many of the wonderful opportunities and affordances that you get when you write an alien contact story. He chose not to take some others. So this was a place where I kind of had some questions. So I really loved when we found out that the Iridians did not know anything about radiation because they don't have to. So, I mean, we humans, so our science is at a quite similar level to the Iridians, but obviously very different because of our ecosystems and atmospheres and pressure. So I thought that was awesome. Like, he did such a great thought experiment of like, what might aliens look like if they lived with completely different gravity, atmosphere, and elements. And so that was really, really fun. And this idea that the Iridians didn't know about radiation, and we won't spoil, but there's a lot of things that they don't know about, basic science concepts that we 100% base our laws of physics on, quote unquote, the laws of physics, right? So I thought that was super fun and really, really well done. But then it seemed like Weir didn't take up the other side of that, which is like pointing out some crazy stuff that humans don't know.
But there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of they are learning from each other. The stuff that the Iridians don't know, because they don't have eyes as we understand them, they cannot see light, they don't understand radiation. And the Iridians understand things with metals that humans have not yet figured out. And they work together so well, those two blind spots, so that they have all the information that they need to solve the big crisis.
Well, it speaks to how, you know, if you have a dog or a cat or if you go to the zoo or something like that, different animals could have a totally different interaction with the world than the human experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, whether you're a human in Africa or Australia or Europe or Asia or, you know, Antarctica or, you know, North or South America, we're all human. We all should have a lot of things that are similar as far as how we interact with the world. But, yeah, another animal or another being could interact with it differently.
As long as all of our sensors work. The interaction of a blind person, the interaction of, you know, someone else who doesn't have the same abilities that we have, their perception is different. And that's what we're looking at with this alien race.
And so whenever we see aliens who have, first of all, different perceptions, as well as different environments, it kind of raises these epistemological questions, right? Like, what do we know? How do we know it? And how is knowledge built on our own perceptions and our own context? And again, I thought he did a fantastic job of that. Now, to me, it felt like the thing that the Iridians had that humans didn't have is also pretty easy for us to conceptualize. I guess that's what I was saying, Steve. Like, there wasn't, you know, a lot of my favorite aliens, like the ones in Asimov's The Gods Themselves or in Butler's Xenogenesis trilogy, the two books that I just mentioned, they have a perception that humans don't, that are really hard to even explain to humans because they're so alien. Whereas the Iridians have perfect memory. So that sounds awesome, but super easy to understand. And Correct. They never developed computers because they basically have their computers in their heads already. So, I mean, it was cool, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't stretch epistemology the way that aliens sometimes can. I loved, and I think, Steve, you probably loved this too, that Rocky would always make the Iridian alien would kind of make fun of Grace at a certain point, like, you're so bad at math. And this was hilarious to, like, me, because of course Ryland Grace is like, oh, let me do super complicated calculus to explain that to you. Da, 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 da. And he's doing it on the back of an envelope, right? And I'm like, oh my goodness, like, I don't even know what he's talking about right now. But to our Iridian friend, like, Grace has hardly any math at all.
I love that. I love
it's
that.
It's very
that
charming. Change.
Because Andy Weir wrote The Martian. The Martian is the most adventurous math I have ever read in my life. It is a book based on math. And here we have a book that is very much about math, but we have this alien who's so much better at it and is just flummoxed by how slow at the math our human is.
I kept getting reminded as reading this book about most of us interact with the world. Like, when you get in a car, you don't really think of how the engine's really working and all that other stuff. But if you ever had to sit down and, like, I don't know, write a formula on how an engine works, I don't know if I could do it.
And this is such a grander scale.
Yeah. And you know, what you're talking about is a spaceship or the environment or how
physics thrust itself,
or,
yeah.
You're talking about, so you're recognizing that there's this massive body of knowledge that he has to draw from to be able to solve his issues. You recognize why he's on this trip.
And what a brilliant way Andy Weir gives him all of the information that he needs from the internet and just says it's all in the hard drive on the ship. Like, perfect. Thanks, Andy.
Right. And they put absolutely everything. They're just like, we don't know what these astronauts are going to need, so we're going to put absolutely everything. They probably won't need to play, like, Minesweeper 3.1, but it just in case they do, it's there. And sure enough, Ryland Grace has to call upon some pretty weird stuff. You guys, I loved the linguistics portion of this. Right?
Yes.
I loved that the Iridians, they speak in these musical tones. I thought the audiobook, did you guys also do the audiobook?
Mm-hmm.
Great job.
Yes, making that tone something that we can hear, that we can perceive what we're talking about in this, because what is speech other than just manipulation of sound waves in a certain way that we know what we mean when we make that noise? And that's what these aliens do, and it sounds so musical to Grace.
Da, 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 da.
Aha.
And Rocky can actually make 5 notes at once. So Grace actually realizes, like, oh, that's a diminished 7th chord, or that's a dominant 5th, or whatever. And so, as someone who studied music with great interest, and of course, music and math are so closely related, when you study music, you think of it that way. You think it is a language, right? And a dominant 5th does mean something really different than a diminished 7th. And so he really, really captured that. And I thought he had a, you know, it's always a little facile because it has to be when two aliens learn each other's language. I mean, you can't spend the whole book on it. And I thought Weir did a phenomenal job of getting these two creatures to understand each other's language in a reasonable but fairly efficacious way.
And starting with the clock, starting with time as the basis for this conversation was brilliant. I'm going to have to remember that for the next time I meet a new alien race, because every race, we assume, hopefully, will have some sort of estimation of how time passes. And since the Iridians don't have 10 digits, 10 fingers, they have 6, their math is base 6. I was fascinated by the idea of how a race becomes base 10 or base 6, and how their clock is base 6 was phenomenal to me. Somebody has made an Iridian clock, by the way. I put it in the show notes.
Of course they have.
There is an Iridian clock that you can look at and see these characters that he's talking about.
Well, the Mayans' number system was based on 6. Or 12.
12, I think.
Interesting. I wonder if they had more fingers.
Well, and 12 is so perfect because you can divide it in way more ways than 10, right? So 12 is a perfect system for early bartering because you can divide it by 2, 3, 4, or 6.
Yeah, if I need to count more than 10, I need to take my socks off.
But also, they didn't really talk about the fact that even though we use metric a lot, and I think Grace did a nice job of thinking through like imperial... But our clock is 12, right? And so there could have been, I mean, I thought Weir did a fantastic job with the base numbering systems, but there could have been even more. It's such a fascinating topic.
And all of those words that the narrator uses, Grace is fascinated by how his mind translates from metric into imperial. And that is stated in the book as a part of, this is how my mind works. Huh, I wonder why. I guess I must be American.
That was hilarious. That was very funny.
Because he's a scientist, so he does study in metric, but he talks in imperial. It's a fascinating discovery of how numbers and math work, for sure. And I love how Rocky translates into Grace's math. Instead of expressing it the way he's thinking of it, he goes ahead and does the translation because he says that Grace is so bad at math.
Right. And he even says humans are stupid. And he doesn't think, what an offensive thing to say, because he's just using the language that Grace gave him, right? And I love the linguistics where either one of them can say, that is how our culture does it. And that ends the conversation. So they don't say, wait, why would you do that? So I love the sleep, for example. Mm-hmm. So Rocky always watches Grace sleep because that's what Iridians do. Because when they're asleep, they're completely out. They can't be woken. So you always have someone watch you. And I just thought that was such a great detail they had that sort of little conflict where Grace wanted to watch Rocky eat. And he said, no, that is how our culture, in our culture, no one watches me eat. And Grace is like, but science. And you get that conflict between science and culture, right? And he's like, but I need to watch you for science.
I love the way that Weir presents those two concepts and how he's giving us these words for our current lifestyle. Cultural, yes, those people, them, not us, they do it this way, and it's okay that they do it that way. That's just cultural, and it's brilliant. Maybe my favorite part of this, though, is the idea of how the Iridians don't see. They don't have visual sensors, so they don't know anything about light. And because they don't know about light, they don't know about colors. And I love Andy Weir's description of how Grace explains colors as different wavelengths of radiation, that we, as people with eyeballs, sense these colors and they mean things. There's meaning to color. And there's, without light, there is no color. That's actually entered into my conversation with my students about how we use computers, about how light works as a part of your sensing what's on that screen.
I'm thinking of maybe insects. They view color different than humans. So even in our world, how reality gets viewed, I mean, certainly there's a lot of mentions without mentioning, maybe, is how you subjectively interact with the world. I mean, there's no mm-hmm. objective thing here. It's how mm-hmm. you interact with the world.
How you perceive the world and your set of sensors and how those are different and how then we need to understand somebody else's point of view and understanding each other through our differences. This is a really great book that touches on so many of those things, including getting into climate change in this one, Pam.
I know. Sometimes I feel like I see the climate crisis everywhere, but it really is in this book, right? This isn't me just imagining.
Oh, yeah. This is definitely a climate crisis. It's a different climate crisis than we have today, but it is certainly the same rules of we need to solve this in a hurry or we are in trouble.
And we need to do it globally. So to me, there were two really fascinating things that came out of the intersection of the astrophage disaster and our current climate crisis. One is, how do we solve it? And so in Project Hail Mary, they basically give all the world governments, give one person, Dr. Strat, the power to make decisions. And pretty much everyone, it's interesting, he makes her a European woman, and everyone has to, you know, there has to be an authority that makes the decision. We're not going to get consensus on how to solve this, right? Yeah, that's a fascinating thought. And I think mm-hmm. it's one that climate scientists sometimes think, oh my goodness, can't someone just take the reins and make it happen? You know, we can solve climate crisis, but we have to do big things and do them now. We can't convince 7.5 billion people. And so I think that that was pretty powerful, but I don't know that it's feasible, right? Like, this is a place where the realism maybe breaks down a little bit.
But he does confront that. He does confront that she is too powerful for some people. He does have that conversation where some people look at her and go, why am I following her? Why am I listening to her? And yes, it was a pretty simple, because we have agreed she's in charge. There's a little bit of a suspension of disbelief there, but we have to have that piece in order to get to the spoiler reasoning behind this whole story, which is dark. There's some dark moments in there.
Well, I this idea of giving one person the decision, yeah, there's a lot to unpack there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's never been a dictator who's abused that power at all.
And boy, the question of whether or not she is abusing her power is a deep question, because she seems, from our perspective in the writing to be working toward this grand goal, but is she taking advantage in some portions? Some people in the story think so.
And she herself says, well, as soon as this project is off the ground, I'm going to jail for the rest of my life. Like, I have done a million things that people disagree with, but I don't even care because I'm trying to save humanity.
Right.
Hitler thought the same.
Did he? Really? Wow, that's fascinating. I am fascinated by the way that Andy Weir puts together this character, that we are reasonably sympathetic to her and reasonably afraid of what she could potentially do with this power.
And she has a Spock-like logic, right? So she is really, she's like, no ethics here. Don't talk to me about ethics. We're trying to save humanity, the end. But what no, doesn't matter. What is the solution? Now, I thought it was interesting that the project is called Project Hail Mary, because that's a very
cultural
things to unpack, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like this is obviously, so the prayer Hail Mary is only in the Catholic version of Christianity, because Christianity don't honor the Virgin Mary in the same way that the Catholic branch does. So that's a very, very specific, but this is not like, this is the appropriation of a religious symbol. I think that appropriation started, but I'm not positive, in American sports, like the Hail Mary pass, the like, you're at the end of the football game, you're down by six, the only thing you can do is a 90-yard pass, you know, a 90-yard pass play. And so
American football, not just football.
Exactly, right. Chip, exactly. So the title of this book speaks to the complex politics of appropriation, of power, of dictatorship, of one person taking the reins and being like, this is our only chance.
And it's such a middle school teacher joke too, because the ship is called the Hail Mary, and what is it full of? A guy named Grace. That's the only thing in the ship is a guy named Grace. Hail Mary, full of grace.
Oh, I was my like, gosh. Yeah, I didn't Andy even see Weir, that, Steve. Exactly.
Andy Weir, I really like Andy Weir. I think Andy Weir and I could really be best friends.
Well, I totally missed that. But for all you kids who went to Catholic school, maybe you guys.
Because I went to Catholic school, that was my first thought. When I found out the ship is called the Hail Mary and the astronaut is called Grace, I went, oh, Andy. Oh.
And, you know, as we record this, this is the first weekend of American college football. So, you know, of course, Notre Dame, touchdown Jesus, is at the end. Right over the stadium, baby. Touchdown Jesus.
There you go.
Now, the other thing that's fascinating about climate change, other than like how do we solve it and all the ethical and rational conundrums that might accompany that, is the notion that our burning of fossil fuels and the attendant global warming actually gives humans a few extra years in this totally unexpected and much faster moving disaster situation.
The sun eating
challenge. That's a sun eating way. Challenge coming to Twitter, the sun eating challenge,
right? And then there's this fascinating moment where Strat goes to a climate scientist and is like, okay, I need you to create more global warming, we need more time. And so he's like, whoa, I can't do that, like that's against my ethics. And she's like, what, of course you're gonna do it. And of course he does. But that notion of like, there's two things there. I think there's that sort of the happy accident that our bad behavior has actually created a ballast against this disaster and the sort of coincidental nature of that. But then I think there's also the notion that like all of this is anthropogenic. Like we do have our future. We do hold our future in our own hands. There's no question about whether humans have affected the climate or not, which is exactly what the new climate report says unequivocally. all of this climate crisis is anthropogenic or is human-made. Mm-hmm. Something that Weir obviously shows in this novel.
Once again, the way Andy Weir gives us that data in such a narrative fashion, this is a wonderful way to look at the climate crisis, to think about what we're doing, to think about how we know how to make global warming, and therefore we know how to make global warming stop. It's just a matter of whether we can negotiate enough with each other to make that happen. I love the way he puts that.
And without totally spoiling, and Steve, you can take this out if you need to, I do think that when it comes to the climate crisis, the book actually believes that humans can, we can work together, we can do it. And so there is a moment, and we don't know, but there is a moment where Ryland Grace is by himself in space and he's thinking about Earth. And he says, how bad did it get back on Earth? Did they work together to survive? Or did millions die in wars and famine? I bet they did work together. Maybe it's just the childish optimism in me, but humanity can be pretty impressive when we put our minds to it. After all, everyone worked together to build the Hail Mary. That was no easy feat. And so I think there's a strain of optimism that goes through this book and that is so captured in Ryland Grace's sense of wonder, sense of awe at the power of the universe, but also the ability of humans.
Is that a very American way of looking at this too? And what I'm saying is there's an optimism there. Americans are a very optimistic group in general compared to some other cultures.
It's definitely an American novel that definitely scratches that itch for me that has a spoiler, good ending, not a destruction of everything ending. And the way that we get there is very American. It's very Bruce Willis. He was being sent to the asteroid to save the world.
Yippee-ki-yay, baby.
He's our last hope, one in a million shot. And I think you're right. It's probably very American and very Catholic upbringing to call it Hail Mary and very pop culture nerd and very middle-aged Gen Xer.
Do you have to feel guilty about it, Steve? Is there a lot of guilt involved in this?
He does discuss a little bit of how he feels guilty having left his students. Like he fantasizes about what are they doing? What are they suffering in all of this? And then he comes back to, but wait, I'm here to help them, to save them, what I was meant to do. And yeah, there's a little bit of guilt in there. So what do you think, Pam? Is this a book that you would recommend to most people, or is this a very specific group of people that you would suggest this book to?
This is absolutely a book I've already recommended to many people, and it's not targeted at us, even though it feels like especially targeted at us. I think it's a book with a really, really broad appeal.
What do you think, Chip?
I'm with you. I think this is certainly worthy of dinner party conversations, certainly worthy of a general audience, and you know, just a fun pop read.
Is this a pop read, or is this more sciencey than general use?
I think there's science in it. I don't think that all the readers have to understand the science or what he was going through. I think that you can get through it. And I think there's an appreciation of the knowledge it takes to be able to get to this. And my hope is that you'll have an appreciation of how every one of your neighbors has some kind of specialization in their particular knowledge.
And he explains everything at a middle school level. So I actually think, even though it does have a lot of science and math, he creates the mechanism where he can tell it to us at a middle school level. So it doesn't feel like he's speaking down to the reader when he explains like how radiation works, because I'm like, oh my goodness, I bet I knew this when I was 12, but I don't anymore. And he just explains it like I'm 12. So I think that it's artfully done. I wouldn't say it's too sciencey for most people.
So he talks about Excel spreadsheets, but doesn't ask you to do them.
Exactly.
Another brilliant use of the middle school teacher as narrator is exactly. He is able to explain it in a way that most people, most 12-year-olds or 12-year-olds at heart, like me and Chip, could understand it. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Pam. Again, that's Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir. Go out and read this book or get the Audible and listen to the narrator because it is so well done.
Hey, you can't get those walks done by just, you know, listening to music.
I don't listen to music.
I do.
Or walk.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. Is there anything interesting happening in the news? I haven't been watching the news this week, Chip.
Well, all I can say is that Apple, who certainly has made a stand on privacy and how important things are to be encrypted and how they can unlock their cell phones to for law enforcement or to stop, you know, any number of terrible things that you can imagine happening in the world, has somehow found a way to allow a computer program to go into your particular piece of hardware, your phone, not on your backup, your phone, and basically go through it. And what they're looking for are things like child pornography, which we all admit is bad. But if you can do it for something like that, you can do it for something else. So Edward Snowden actually wrote about this. He said, listen, at this point, what good is Apple?
If encryption is broken, encryption is broken. If it is encrypted and no one can get to it except for the intended receiver and the sender, then wonderful. If it's broken, it's broken. Even if it's broken a little bit, then the next thing, child pornography is terrible. Awful. We don't want child pornography. But what's the next thing that somebody, some government, some individual is going to say, this is morally wrong, we are going to stop it? And where's the landslide stop at that point?
Well, imagine you're a person in Afghanistan and you're trying to get out. And all of a sudden there is some way to get into your hidden files. Imagine you're in Hong Kong and you are fighting for one side or the other. All of a sudden your information is getting out and it's showing you the weakness of this technology, our dependence upon it and the weakness of it. At some point, we're going to have some kind of agreement that what is allowed and what's not allowed. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, what they're trying to find, child pornography, is even remotely ethical. What I am suggesting is that if you can figure out a way to scroll your particular phone, not your backups, your phone, for things like that, you can find it for anything. Mm-hmm.
And who knows what tyrannical power is going to search for who knows what immoral thing that they deem immoral, and then we're all out in the open. We're all unprotected. If I believe a certain way, if it's cultural, then I should have that right. And a Bill of Rights, an agreement between these companies would be one step toward that. But that even that doesn't take away that idea of some tyrannical person making a decision.
We all saw the challenges from a few years ago when I think it was through the iCloud that it was broken through and a lot of celebrities' private information was released to the public. And certainly that's terrible and should be condemned. And I think they did find the person who did that. The point though is that there could be private company materials. There could be any number of things that should remain private. Your attorney's information to you, your private medical records, should these be public on any level? And what happens if they get released? And we've got is we don't have a way to create that barrier. I think deep down, this is what Cory Doctorow is fighting for. It's like, hey, listen, we're going to have some kind of divide between what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. no one is arguing child pornography is reasonable, but if you can crawl through your photos for that, you can crawl through the rest of it for something else. Or worse, place something on your phone.
You don't even have to place it on your phone. You just have to accuse someone that it was there and we found it. That the slippery slope here is a very dangerous situation.
Well, we're going to continue to monitor this. I do know that some Apple employees are pushing back. And I just don't know how Tim Cook is going to be able to justify this. I mean, it just seems terrible.
I agree. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
What do you think, Pam?
I'll be listening next week.
Aw. Thank you so much for coming in and discussing this one last book of our series of books that we went through last year. If those of you who haven't tuned in to Sandwiches at Irregular Hours, Pam, you are brilliant. You are wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was such a fun conversation.
If you need more information, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on iTunes and Stitcher and TuneIn Radio. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasselblad.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
So we'll see you in the future. What I want to talk about, what I want to thank you for, what I want to.